Welcome to Steel Watching, the podcast for Remington Steel fans. I am Eric, one of your hosts.
And I am Sarah, the other one of the hosts.
Who almost forgot to say who she was.
I did. I was trying to think of a clever, I usually have a clever, like, funny way to introduce myself, and I couldn't think of one today. So.
Yes. Well, okay.
I'm not as funny as I think I am.
But we do have something special this morning. You and I both get to apologize for screwing up.
Wee! I was going to say, you're not going to sing again, are you? Because I'm getting
No. I said that was it. That was over. Anyway, yes, we each had a little bit of a screw up, although mine was probably a little bit bigger, but because yours can be justified because, after all, you're just Canadian, and what do you know about hockey?
Ouch. Ouch. Okay.
It's not like you guys invented the game.
The gloves are off, okay?
Okay. I'll start out. I'll take the first hit. While I was editing the episode Blood is Thicker Than Steel, before it was released, before anybody heard it, I caught a mistake. Well, kind of a mistake. It's technically a mistake, but not really. You remember we were talking about how Angel would have gotten out of the RV. Without making noise, without having to jump down from the windows, which are, you know, set fairly high up, which would cause some noise that Steel and Laura would have heard. And you commented about the ladder that was on the back.
Yeah.
And I said, but there's no window on the back. Well, okay, there is a window on the back. But, but it is a fixed window. She could not have gotten out of it. It's not a slider. It doesn't push open. There's no way for her to have gotten through it. So, technically, I was wrong. There is a window, but functionally, I was not too far wrong because she couldn't use it. So I will take half of a hit on that. So that's mine. Time for yours.
So, okay.
Yes, I'm relishing
there.
This.
Was a commenter that said that I was wrong about the cheerleaders in hockey. And I will say that while some teams apparently do have something called ice girls, I've never seen it, like not ever. And it didn't, like, so I'm looking at it right now because I looked up the history on it. The first team, the NHL's first ice girls team appeared in 2000 and 2001, and it was the New York Islanders. So, like, a lot of these teams that have ice girls are American, so I'm just saying it's definitely not a Canadian tradition.
That's your excuse, huh?
It's true. Like, Toronto does not have, right? So apparently now it's becoming a trend, but there weren't any in the 80s, so I'm still right about that.
Well, they were setting the trend. They were creating the trend. They were ahead of the wave.
So I will say that this is not something that is, if you're a Canadian and you were to tell a Canadian that there are cheerleaders in hockey, we'd go, I've never seen it on the games. Like, I've never seen them. Like, when I watch the games on TV, it must be a thing that you see when you're at the game. Well, they do before or after whatever, but I've never seen it. So,
yeah, the email we specifically got was that the Carolina Hurricanes, which were the 2005-2006 Stanley Cup champions, do have cheerleaders called Canes Crew, and they are in the stands during the game as well as walking through the arena through the game. So, yeah, you're right. You probably wouldn't see them unless the camera panned up to the stands and caught sight of them.
Yeah. So,
I will forgive you for being wrong. Anyway. Ready to get into the episode?
1984. Yeah.
All right. Episode, season 2, episode 16, Small Town Steel, first aired February 28th, 1984, was written by Jeff Melvoin and directed by Seymour Robbie.
Seymour! Hey, Seymour!
Hey, can I, I'm sorry, I'm totally off subject here. Something that's been bugging me for a while. Totally off topic of this episode, but steel related.
Okay. Steel related. Okay. Get it? Steel related.
Yeah, funny. Yeah. And this is a question, not necessarily for you, Sarah, but for maybe some of our listeners. Judith, I'm talking about you. First of all, would you agree that the name Melvoin is kind of a non-common name?
It is definitely not a name that I have heard ever until like this. Yeah.
And would you, based on the fact that it's not a terribly common last name, would you presume that if you had two people named Melvoin, that they are somewhat closely related?
I would assume that.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so we've got Jeff Melvoin here in the show. He's one of the writers, producers, directors. And my question is, what is his relationship to the late Mike Melvoin, who was a jazz musician, composer, arranger, musical director, did all kinds of stuff. I mean, he worked on Barbra Streisand movie, did the music for the Barbra Streisand movie, the boxing one, whatever the name of that one was, I don't remember. I mean, he's worked on all kinds of TVs and movies, The Right Stuff, Bad News Bears in Japan, Partridge Family, MacGyver, Buck Rogers. I mean, he's been all over the place, and it's been bugging me. What is the relationship between those two? If anybody knows, just send me a note.
Okay.
Anyway, totally unrelated to the episode.
Yeah.
All right. I just had to get it out. Okay. So let's get on to the synopsis. I went with the DVD liner notes. No, I didn't. I went with the TV guide listing. No, I didn't. I wrote my own.
Wow. Okay. This is escalated quickly.
Well, there were things I liked about each of the two, the DVD liner notes and the TV guide listing, but I didn't like either one. I'm going to read those two after I read the official Steel Watching synopsis. Yes. All right. So the one we're going with is when Laura and Steele travel to the small California village of Donata to investigate the disappearance of a historian, they get the feeling the whole town is hiding something from them. That's my version. The DVD liner notes were when the investigators travel to a small California village of Donata on a missing persons case, they get the feeling the whole town is hiding something from them. The TV guide listing is Laura and Steele investigate the disappearance of a historian who stumbled on a small town's well-guarded secret. So I kind of took the two and stuck them together and came up with
fair enough. What
we're doing as the official.
I love the fact that the town is literally like Donata means you're welcome in Spanish.
Oh, does it? Oh, okay.
So the town is literally called you're welcome.
Now leave.
It's funny.
You're welcome. Now leave. Yeah. Anyway, so the episode starts and Snoopy would love this. Because this is the opening line for every book Snoopy's ever written. It was a dark and stormy night.
Not to mention the plane thing, right? He's always doing the.
So we see
the Red Baron.
Yes, we see an aged airplane flying through the late night storm, wind, rain, thunder, lightning. We see the pilots are fighting for control. One engine is on fire. And we are also treated to the vision of large bank bags, all labeled with the Cleveland First Citibank name on them. Full of money. And then we see shots of the airplane in a dive. The dial on the altimeter is running down, and these shots are all interspersed throughout the sequence. And clearly, this is not going to end up well for the two men in the plane
who have
apparently been up to naughtiness.
So, how could you tell?
A lot of money with bank bags. Yeah, usually banks don't fly the money around like that with just two guys in the middle of nowhere for nothing. Fair. Anyway, we cut to the shot of a grandfather clock. It's nearly 5 o'clock. And then we see an older gentleman, gray hair, glasses, bow tie, tweed jacket. He's in a library doing some sort of research. But as he sits, absorbed in his work, oblivious to the fact that he's being watched by the other patrons of the library who are staring at him, and they're repeatedly giving him sidelong glances. He continues his research, getting up, getting books, bringing them back to his desk. Then we again see the clock. It's 5 o'clock straight up. One by one, the other patrons get up and begin to leave, with most giving him a look as they do, until we again focus on the older gentleman, and then we hear the ominous sounds of door slamming, shutter slamming. The old man hears it as well and realizes that something isn't right. He looks up from his work to see the exterior shutters from the windows around the room slamming shut, and then the lights go out.
He's just misunderstanding what's going on here. I can tell you what's happening here, right? Like, he thinks that they're
kidnapping
him.
Is this a Buffy reference? Is this a Buffy reference?
No, this is not a Buffy. I promise this is not a Buffy reference. But, like, what's happening here, okay, is that these people want to go home. Like, the library's closed, man. Like, I used to work in a department store, and I used to do the announcement at the end of the night, you know. Good evening, Zeller's shoppers. The time is now 8:45, and Zeller's, it's basically the get the heck out announcement, right? So, like, you know, you've always got that customer that shows up at 5 minutes to closing, and they're like, I just need to get one thing, and then they stand there browsing. No, no, it's 5 o'clock, pal. We're just locking you in. That's what's happening. That's my theory.
Well, that is what's happening, but although that is what's happening, there's probably more reasons for it than just it's 5 o'clock, get out. Anyway, so he runs across the darkened room to the door. He grabs the knob, tries turning it, and then shaking the door, trying to get out. And then he begins pounding on the door, shouting, wait, wait, there's been a mistake. Let me out. Then suddenly the light from a flashlight falls on his face, a torch for our friends from the mother country. Yep. A young man.
My husband calls it that all the time. And I'm like, wait, what? What are we setting on fire? I don't understand.
A young man tells him, I think you'd better come with me, Professor Thicket. Well, the older man moves toward the younger man, then suddenly bolts, knocking the younger man back. The professor runs out the door, the back of the library, then down the boardwalk sidewalk of the darkened town. Suddenly, he is grabbed by two men and dragged off. As he is, we see a sign welcoming visitors to Donata, America's best-kept secret.
Maybe he just didn't pay his library fines. They're really strict about that.
They could be. It could very well be.
I think you better come with us, Professor.
You're a month overdue. Those fines are really getting accumulated. Every day, it's more and more. Next, we see Laura and Steele in the rabbit with Laura driving in what seems to be a reasonable matter, driving through the desert. Yeah. But they're lost. Steele hopefully suggests that perhaps they should have turned left at the intersection some 10 miles back. And Laura reminds him that he was the one who told her to turn right. And he excuses it by saying that, well, left was merely a suggestion.
Okay.
Yeah. Reminds me of
Bugs Bunny.
Lucille Ball in the long trailer. They've got this huge, huge trailer that they're pulling behind their car, and they're coming up to an intersection or an off ramp, and Lucy hollers at him, "Turn right here, left." Of course, by that point, it's too late. He's already turned right. Yeah. So yeah.
Anyway. I was thinking more along the lines of Bugs Bunny going, "Should have taken that left turn at Albuquerque."
Yeah. Well, there's that too. Yes. It's been a long time since I've seen Bugs Bunny. I forget those things. Mm. Anyway, Steele rhapsodizes about how invigorating it is being in the countryside with all the birds and the trees and the flowers. But Laura, who has been sneezing, doesn't agree, citing dust, pollen, sneeze, hay fever.
She didn't seem to have any allergies in Steele's gold. And they don't ever do this again in any of the other episodes where she's like, there's another episode later on where they end up in a smaller town all in denim, and she's not sneezing then, so.
Yeah, and in fact I even also have that in my notes that I got it a little later down, because after she makes her comment and Steele chastises her for her antipathy for the great outdoors, dismissively saying that he thought she was the all-American girl, she says, no, you know, when she was 12, she was drummed out of the Girl Scouts for demanding an electric blanket on an overnight. And my comment was, in season one, Steele's Gold, for example, she displayed no such attitude about being out in the cold.
She was fine with it.
Or allergies, yes. So another little minor inconsistency, but we won't.
Interestingly, though, they were both written by Jeff Melvoin.
Well, hey, that was last season. I forgot.
Yeah. Well, just because it was him with the stop that carrot idea, right? And then
that's true.
And so it's also interesting that he likes to write these episodes where they're out of their element, where they're not in the city. They're chasing after some sort of MacGuffin. It's kind of a Yeah, that comparison.
Does, yeah, that does seem to be something that he's doing. We'll see if that carries forward with his other episodes as they go on in the future. Anyway, Laura continues stating that she is unashamedly a city girl. She prefers the country club, tennis, golf, cocktails by the cabana. And Steele suggests that she consider this excursion into the real Americana. You know, like being part of a Frank Capra movie.
Like, what's the city, fake? Like, I always find it funny when people are like, well, this is the real Canada or the real America or the real this or the real that. And it's like, it's just a different... But it's also interesting that he mentions Frank Capra movies because for the longest time, like in their day, Frank Capra movies were looked down upon greatly by critics. Critics referred to his films as Capricorn because they were so cheesy and so like schmaltzy. And like now, of course, we look at them and I've studied him in film classes. But like back then, he was not regarded very highly by his peers.
Well, he was painting a picture of America that was very, very idealized, kind of like, okay, I'll bring it up again. Like when a woman puts on makeup to go out.
Oh, here we go again.
I knew it. But I mean, you think about it. She's going out. She wants to look her best. She puts on her makeup and she's presenting herself in the best possible light she can. That doesn't really match up with her day to day, you know, taking care of the kids, going to work, whatever. And that's what Frank Capra did in his movies. He idealized America and elements of the American life. And so, understandably, the critics were kind of, well, that's not reality. But,
I think it's actually interesting that Steele says this, right, about how, like, you know, Frank Capra and the real America being this idealized version. And then we find out through this episode that this small town is anything but that idealized version, right? Because if you go into any small town, people always rhapsodize about small town life and how wonderful and close-knit communities are. And they are. I'm not saying those don't exist, but like there's always some dark side to every small town. There's always some secrets or, you know, things that people know your business and they. So this is kind of funny how it ends up being literally just like, oh, it's so idealized, except it's not.
Well, I've got a comment about Steele's attitude toward Frank Capra movies here a little bit later on, which I'll get to as we get more appropriately located in the episode. But when he mentions Frank Capra, I do have an issue because Laura says, who? I mean, seriously, believe that she doesn't know who Frank Capra is? She's exhibited a reasonable knowledge of film. And I point to her reference to Boomtown in Steel Sweet on You not too long ago, which I would think she would be less likely to know as a reference than a Frank Capra movie. I mean, who doesn't know It's a Wonderful Life?
Right. Like that one is, even if you've never seen it, you know it. Like, you know it because there's been so many things that have been made as an homage or in sort of the same vein. Mm-hmm. There's been every TV show has done an episode of what would life have been like if this person didn't exist? Like it happens all the time because of that film. That concept is very well known. So,
I think if I remember correctly, and I may be remembering this wrong because I'm old and my memory doesn't work so well. I think that in the past there have been television, at least one television commercial that used bits from that, or they used, you know, like a synthesized version from that where, you know, how they're taking people who are dead and using them in commercials and such. I think that Wonderful Life was used in one of those types of commercials
at
some point.
It's kind of like A Christmas Carol, even if you've never read the Charles Dickens novel. And
you've seen the Muppet version, though.
You've seen the Muppet version, or you've seen, you know, Patrick Stewart's version, or you've seen like the 11 billion versions of that film that are out there, and you know it, right? So in this case, I think she would know it, too.
Yeah.
I find it odd if she says she doesn't.
So anyway, Steele references It's a Wonderful Life and Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, Gary Cooper, Main Street of America, the town square, bandstand smack in the middle. And Laura says she was more interested in the ballet that she was planning to attend that evening. And Steele doesn't seem to think the case will interfere with her plans. And with a somewhat disappointed tone, he suggests that since it's only Friday, they'll find Professor Thicket, have her back in time for a cultural dip in Swan Lake. But Laura is pessimistic, saying that the professor's sister says that the professor would never come back late from a research trip. And so then we see Steele pick up a photo of the professor so that we know that the man we saw earlier is the same professor.
Yeah.
And Steele says that the sister also said that the professor was the archetype absent-minded professor, that he probably got caught up in his studies somewhere and forgot what time it was and that it was supposed to be time to come home. And in any case, he couldn't have gone far, dismissing the professor as looking as helpless as a baby. Yeah, well, I mean, I would think that would mean that he probably could have wandered pretty far.
Exactly. If you've ever had a toddler in a crowded mall and turned around and suddenly they're not there, you will know that they can get quite far in what feels like the span of half a second.
Yes, yes. Which is why leashes for kids are so popular these days.
Yep, I had one for my daughter, actually. I'm not ashamed. She was a runner, and we live on a very busy street, so I would, I leashed her.
Anyway, during the course of this conversation, we learned that Professor Thicket is a well-known historian specializing in small-town America, and that Laura read one of his books while she was in college, but it was awful. And then she sneezes again. And then we cut to one of the men that we'd seen previously eyeing the professor in the library is the attendant at the local gas station in Donata. And as he fills the rabbit with gas, we see that Steele is less than impressed with the town. Apparently, Frank Capra never visited Donata.
Yeah, I got a question. And I don't know if you can answer this because, like, this is more southern U.S. cultural stuff. But, like, is it common? Like, I've been to Tombstone, Arizona, right? Is it common for towns, like, out in the desert now to not have, like, paved roads? Like, those are all dirt roads running through the town still.
Well, I'm going to say these days, right now, as we're recording this in 2024, that's probably not terribly common. But okay. I'm going to say that there probably are places like that that still, at least, you know, they may have a main road that's paved, but they're still going to have like side roads and such that aren't.
Yeah. Well, it looks like your typical Western, right? Like this, the whole set.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, do they still exist? Do towns that look like that still exist? Because like, it's cool. Like I would go there just for the experience of it. But well, maybe not Donata, but not the friendliest place on the planet, but apparently you go there, you never leave. You
know? Yes. But, also known as the Hotel California.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So anyway, the man begins chatting, asking if they're just passing through, and which I'm guessing is probably what most people do when they see the town.
They have a boarding house.
Well, I mean.
And there's.
Maybe you get the occasional person stopping over, but, you know, relative or whatever, but.
I would think they'd go out of business in a town that chases away all strangers, though, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, you would think so.
They even have a guest book. Like, it looks like they've had.
A lot of people there, yeah.
A lot of people stay there. So it's just kind of funny that they're like, we don't like strangers, but come and stay in our boarding house. And don't forget to sign the guest book. It's a little weird.
Yeah. Anyway, so Laura tells him that no, they're looking for a friend who's staying there. And suddenly the man seems a little less cordial, suggesting that not only do they not get many strangers in Donata, well, you know, the fact is we really don't like them that much. Yeah. Steele shows the man the professor's picture, or at least he tries to, but the man avoids looking at the picture, insisting he's never seen him. Nope, never seen him. Then, after paying for the gas, Steele and Laura are at the local boarding house that you just mentioned.
$5 for gas. He asked for $5 for gas. I wish it still cost $5 for gas.
First of all, back then gas prices were a lot cheaper.
I know. I almost cried when he's like, "That'll be $5," and I'm like, "Are you kidding me? That's a bagel and a coffee." Like,
no, that's a coffee.
Well, I guess it depends bagel on where you get your coffee. Yeah. Like here, our gas, like now we do our gas prices differently. You guys, I think, do yours by the gallon. We do ours by the liter. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, ours are like $1.40, but that would be like it costs me $60 now to fill my tank. It used to cost me $30. So
yeah. I remember when I was a kid, one of the few memories I actually do have of my childhood, which I don't have a lot of, but I remember gas wars. And, you know, for anybody who's really young and has no concept of what the term is, no, we're not talking about something over in the Middle East. We're talking about where gas
stations.
He's talking
about a farting competition.
No, you'd have multiple gas stations on an intersection, and they're each trying to out underprice
changing the prices. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it was, I remember it getting down to like 20 cents a gallon when I was a kid. I mean, believe it or not, yes, 20 cents a gallon. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So
$5 for gas. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
I want to go to Donata. Oh, my tank.
Yeah, it's funny because here in Anchorage, our gas for regular is about $3.60 a gallon. But up the road in a small town called Palmer, which is about roughly an hour away, it's like $3.20 a gallon, which is surprising.
But then you have to drive there, so you're wasting the gas to.
Yeah, but it's surprising because usually the farther away you get from a distribution center, the higher the price because they have to truck it there. But no. Not here. So, no, I just happened to be up there the other day and saw their gas prices and said, I'm filling up.
Because anyway, I'm filling up my car, yeah.
Anyway, as we were saying, after the pay for the gas, Laura and Steele are at the local boarding house. And it seems like the house dog isn't any more friendly than the gas station attendant was.
No,
the young woman at the boarding house says that Mary Jane, the apparent owner of the boarding house, isn't there at the moment, but that she doesn't remember anyone like the man in the photo staying there. Now, Laura makes an attempt to look at the register, but the woman says, well, I can't let you do that. And Steele tries to change the woman's mind. But just then, the sheriff walks in asking the woman, whose name is Betty Lynn, if there's a problem. Well, Betty Lynn says that these strangers want to look at the register. And the sheriff goes into his small town hick sheriff act, spitting out juice from his chewing tobacco and then complaining about having the juice landing on his boots. I just got these.
This is what he does on the side when he's not the principal of Shermer, Illinois High School. Like that's the principal from the Breakfast Club.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. Gets right up in Judd Nelson's face and how about another detention and another? Yeah, that's him.
Haven't seen the movie, so I wouldn't know. Anyway, so he's there.
I need
there
to make a list for you. Like a list of 80s films, quintessential 80s films that you
might as well just buy a book that lists them all.
The Princess Bride, The Breakfast Club. Like these are good movies.
Okay. Anyway, so Steele thinks that the presence of the sheriff is a good sign. He references Ward Bond, the kindly lawman, staple of the American small town. And just for anybody who doesn't know, Ward Bond was an actor who often played policemen, soldiers, sailors, and cowboys, frequently cast in films by John Ford, and who also appeared as the policeman in It's a Wonderful Life.
Yep.
As well as Detective Tom Poolhouse in The Maltese Falcon. Anyway, the sheriff seems helpful to the point of being suspiciously over-solicitous.
Yeah, he's very kind, considering the others in the town so far.
Yes, and it should be a red flag for somebody, but apparently it's not. But he suggests to Betty Lynn that she should just let these good people see the register, and if Mary Jane pitches a fit, put the blame on me. Well, Betty Lynn reluctantly turns the register over to Laura, who quickly discovers that, conveniently, there's a page missing, ripped right out. Never happened before that movie.
Yeah, exactly right.
Anyway, Betty Lynn pretends to be surprised and then says, oh, yeah, that. I spilled some ink on it, so I just pulled the page out. Sure. Anyway, the sheriff
spots. Which is the silliest excuse because even if you did, it's not like it's something that important. I'm not really sure why they feel like. Why they'd ripped it out in the first place? Because Steele and Laura know he was there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the sheriff confirms it and says, oh, yeah, he headed up to Bishop. So, like, seeing that he signed the guest book is not going to incriminate them one way or another when the sheriff just confirms it anyway.
Yeah. And if they were concerned about the fact that he hadn't checked out, oh, they could just fake it. I mean, pencil whip that thing, you know?
Yeah. He forgot to sign it or he, whatever. Like, yeah, it's easy enough to spin that.
Yeah. So anyway, the sheriff spots the photo of the professor that Steele has in his hand and says, well, as you were saying, yes, he remembers the man. And he leads him outside saying that the man came through asking for directions a while back, but he didn't stay in Donata. Said he changed his mind and there wasn't as much research to do around here as he thought there was. So he was going up to Bishop. Well, Laura comments that the professor didn't tell his sister that he was going to Bishop, that he'd changed his plans. And the sheriff explains, well, you know, the phone system around here has been totally unreliable. Heavy rains, you know, previous week. Plays havoc with phone lines. Sure. Miss, you know, I plumb forgot your name. No, you didn't. No, you plum didn't. You never got it. Like, you know it. So anyway, as Steele is about to respond with their names, Laura beats him to it, identifying themselves as Carolyn Bixby and Steele as Felix Hildebrand, colleagues of Professor Thicketts at UCLA. Well, the sheriff introduces himself as Jed Nevins, saying that he's right glad to meet them, then proceeds to try to tell Laura and Steele to basically get out of town, suggesting that he's told them the whole story, but if, you know, they head up to Bishop, they'll find him there. Well, after the sheriff leaves them standing in the middle of the street, Steele expresses his dissatisfaction at being given the name Felix, which is apparently the name of one of Laura's uncles. I'm not sure what is so wrong with the name Felix, but
no, maybe he's, considering he's given her far worse names, right? Yeah. Like Myrtle Groggins comes to mind.
Well, the only thing I can think of is that he's thinking of Felix Unger from The Odd Couple.
Maybe.
I mean, okay, I could see that. Anyway, so when Steele asks why she gave out with fake names and info, she points out that if they're really going to be poking around here, they'd do a lot better if they were college professors rather than big city detectives. And of course, Steele is convinced that Laura's seeing trouble where there is none, urging her to look around, insisting that the town's residents are honest, decent people, the backbone of the country. And of course, he fails to see that many of the people are eyeing them with looks ranging from suspicion to thinly veiled hostility. And even when a boy comes over to shake his hand, the boy's mother rushes over and snatches him away from Steele.
The dog refuses to let them pet him. Even the dog is like, nope, we're not doing this. And he wanders off.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and drop it in here. I have it later in my notes. Steele has never before been so obsessed about believing a movie as reality. He seems to think that Frank Capra's movies reflect reality, and he's bound and determined to hang on to that ideal, despite the fact that he knows that movies are all fake. Where did this come from? Because he's never had this attitude before. He's always used the movies as a reference to kind of guide his thinking, but he's never been so obsessed that, oh, that movie, it's reality.
Well, okay, so I have a theory about this, because it actually kind of connects with the reason why during the Great Depression, not only did the film industry not sort of tank due to everybody being extremely poor, but it actually thrived to the point of it was probably one of the biggest eras for film, right? And most of the films that came out of the 1930s were films about wealthy people in lavish situations and lavish lifestyles and kind of the stuff that people didn't have at the time, right? Like your average film goer was struggling to get by, and yet they were still spending their hard-earned money on the movies because the movies were an escape. They were that place you could go where you didn't have to think about the fact that you couldn't afford food for this week or you lost your house or your mortgage or whatever it was. And I think in this case, it's similar because Frank Capra's movies, I joked about Capricorn, but like they all presented this idealized, happy version of things where things work out in the end. And Jimmy Stewart, like if we look at It's a Wonderful Life, Mm-hmm. Everything's going wrong for him throughout his entire life, it seems, until he witnesses what life would have been like without him and realizes he had more than he realized. And at the end, he's surrounded by those he loves, right? Steele grew up without any of that. And so even though he knows, like you said, he knows objectively movies aren't real, they're fake. I think that maybe these movies are important to him in the sense that they present this idealized version that he wants to be true, whether or not it is. And I think he knows like on some level that it's a fantasy to try to project that movie, idealized movie version onto a reality. But I think he also kind of wants it to be true because he wants to go to like the happy small town with the town square and the bandstand and the people that are also friendly. So,
well, you can want something to be true without giving up your rational thought about your circumstances, you know. And it just seems to me that in this particular instance, because he hangs on to this thing for so long through the episode, that it's just a little out of character in my view. But anyway, we'll go.
He starts to let go of the dream a little bit here when the dog refuses to let him.
Well.
What I'm wondering about, the thing that confuses me throughout the entire episode, is why they're walking around the town. Like, so I looked this place up on a map.
You did too?
Yeah. So it's not just me. Okay. And they're about, what, 3 hours-ish from L.A., something like that? Like, it's a good chunk away, far enough away from L.A. that they're not, but they're still in, like, a warm climate, right? Mm-hmm. LA is a hot city. Like, it's warm pretty much most of the year, right? And they're constantly, Steele is always wearing suits in LA, and Laura's always wearing like pantsuits or skirt suits or whatever. And they're not always covered in sweat. But throughout this entire episode, they're like, there's sweat stains all over their shirts and whatever. And I'm like, why is it that they're cool as a cucumber when they're walking down the hot streets of LA? But the minute they get into Donata, they can't seem to keep a shirt from like soaking through. Like, what's going on here?
I don't know.
And they're wearing objectively less clothing in Donata than they would wear with like the layers that they have on, especially Steele in LA, because he's got like the 3-piece suits, right? So
I guess the only explanation I could think of, and I don't know. Somebody who lives in that area would have to clarify this and either confirm or deny my suspicion.
Help me out here. Anyone who lives there who knows, like.
Based on what we see on the map later when Mildred looks at it, I did a search, and it appears that this location, which, of course, is totally fictitious. The town is fictitious. The location is real. But they are deeper in land than the Los Angeles basin is. And so it's possible, I don't know, somebody from LA help us out here, that in LA they get a little more breeze to keep them cool than they would at this particular location, which I actually have pinpointed the location, and we'll get to that when we get to Mildred's little thing.
We both looked it up on the map.
Yes. Oh, let's. And when we get there, we'll compare our notes and see if we came up with about the same place.
Yeah.
Anyway, so after Steele attempts to make friends with the dog and fails,
Fido does not want to be his friend.
They say that dogs have very good perception as to people. You know,
yeah, that's true. Actually, dogs can sense.
What does this say? Anyway, we see the sheriff walk into his office, where he's greeted by many of the same people who had previously been watching the professor while he was at the library, and they are anxious to know who the strangers are and if they're staying. The sheriff assures them that Lauren Steele are just college types, friends of thickets. He says, as he gestures toward the back of the jail. So we kind of got an idea there that thickets in the back of the jail, and he tells them, well, they'll soon be on their way to Bishop. And then a man we learn is named Winslow sternly responds, well, they'd better be. Well, outside on the boardwalk, Laura and Steele are looking at the Cockpit Diner, last hot food for 40 miles.
Again, they seem to be like advertising in a way that invites people to stop in the town, right? If you're telling people this is the last hot food for 40 miles, you're basically saying, come on in, you're not getting any food, you know, for the next little while, so you might as well eat here. Like,
well, see, here's the thing, though, and this just occurred to me as you were saying that. They don't mind people coming in and staying in their town. They probably didn't mind Thicket showing up. It was only after he started poking around and doing research on the town and finding out things that they didn't want him to find out that they would, you know, start having an issue with it. So
they're kind of funny, though, that they're their own worst enemies when it comes to this, because if they had just like kept their story that, oh, yeah, he went to Bishop, like Laura and Steele would really have. I guess Rachel also kind of screws things up for them. But like if they had just like they'd have no reason to look in the jail.
No.
Unless they put Mildred there. They're not very good at keeping their own secret is all I'm saying.
No, they're not. Anyway, so as they're looking at that restaurant that mounted to the front of the wall of the diner is the cockpit last seen on the airplane, which had been in trouble at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a connection. Anyway.
Hiding in plain sight, I guess, is
exactly
smart in a way.
Exactly.
On the plane,
the purloined letter. Yeah. The purloined letter, yes. Laura asks what the guidebook says about the diner, and Steele curtly responds, avoid the beef. And as they begin to walk toward the diner, Laura comments that they're there for information, not a 4-star meal. And then a young woman in a waitress outfit runs up to them and quickly tells them that they can't stay there and that they're already in danger, then rushes off to the diner. And that was Rachel, who you previously referenced. Inside the diner, Laura and Steele are at a table looking at the menus without even a glass of water on the table. So it's not a very good diner.
Well, I think it's just not a very good diner to them. I think that the service is entirely based on the fact that they don't want them there. So
well, it could be too.
Yeah. And the thing is, too, like what I'm curious as to what Rachel means by they're in danger. They haven't hurt Thicket. He's just chilling out in the jail cell.
Well, so probably.
I guess, but Rachel seems to be the odd part of this episode in the sense that, like, I don't know why she'd even be worried. Because, A, they haven't hurt Thicket, and B, she's going to get a payday out of this as long as she keeps her mouth shut. It doesn't appear, like, even the mayor says, you said no one would get hurt, so it doesn't appear that they have any intention of hurting Thicket, but just letting him go after the timer's passed, so.
Yeah, but, I mean, maybe she is visualizing something else in her mind. She may not have any historical basis for that fear that she has, but she apparently has some sort of concern or fear or whatnot.
Yeah.
Or moral objection to the whole situation or whatever. But anyway, Rachel, the woman that spoke to Laura and Remington outside, is working and furtively glancing their direction and yet seemingly ignoring their attempts to get her attention. And Steele's getting impatient. He stands up, says he's going to have a talk with that young woman, but Laura directs him to sit back down, suggesting that if Thicket is in trouble, they don't want to draw any unnecessary attention to themselves or to that girl. Steele isn't reading the room, as they say. Oh, he continues to be blinded by the false vision of reality portrayed by his favorite movies and being uncharacteristically and unrealistically blind to the real world situation and the unsavory possibilities of that real world, because he again insists that Laura is just being an alarmist. Small town inhabitants have an exaggerated fear of outsiders that must and can be overcome gradually.
He's not wrong in that sense. Like I grew up in London, Ontario, which is about 500,000 people. So it's a city, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved when I was 10 to a tiny little village that's about 2,000 people now. And it was even smaller then, called Belmont. It was about 30 minutes out of the city. And yeah, there were people in that town, in that village, that had been there for generations. So you had to put in the time before you were considered by the elders of the town to be a true Belmonter. And most of the time, like it took us probably about 30 years of living there before we were sort of like, oh yeah, they're part of the town, right? Because there was people that had been there for their families and their families and their families and their families. So like there is a bit of an exaggerated fear of outsiders. Like if you move to Belmont, tomorrow, you got to put in the time. Otherwise, you're just from, it's similar to, I don't know if anybody here is listening from Newfoundland or the East Coast of Canada, but anybody who's not from the mainland, like the East Coast views anybody from the mainland of Canada as from away. So when you visit the East Coast, you go to Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, Newfoundland, the first thing they'll say is, oh, you've come from away. We're in the same country, but we're really not. Like, there's very much of a distinct difference in maritime culture versus the rest of Canada. So it's sort of that same idea of like, they've come from away. They're not from here. This is our sort of like cultural space. And you don't really get that as much in a city because it's so big and so dense and so populated that you kind of have to be a little bit more individualistic rather than like community minded. So I don't think he's essentially wrong. I just think he's a little bit focused on this idealized version.
No, he's not wrong in the sense that what he's saying is accurate in many, many cases, but what he's saying is wrong in this particular case because it's not a matter of them just warming up to them.
Oh, no.
And it should be fairly obvious that they are openly hostile, and there's something more to it than just, oh, you're from outside. Okay.
Yeah, so, no, I agree with you.
anyway, Steele's determined to prove his point. So he gets up, walks over to the counter, and tries to begin chatting up two of the men that we had seen earlier as part of that, what now seems to be a conspiracy of silence. Steele shows them the picture of the professor and asks if they've seen him, but his inquiry is met with stone-faced indifference and silence.
Yeah, they don't even, like, respond. They just stare
at him. No, just, like, look at him and, like, go away. So anyway, frustrated at the failure in front of Laura, as much as I think anything, as much as the failure for its own sake, he returns to the table and attempts to put a positive spin on the outcome, claiming to just have been laying the groundwork. Yeah, right.
Yeah. He talks about them like they're zoo animals, right? Yeah. Like, you just have to approach them slowly, throw them a treat. Like,
yeah, really. No, sorry, that dog is still going to bite you. Anyway,
the mayor, that dog snubbed him. He didn't even think he was worth biting. It was just like, nope.
Anyway, the mayor and the man that we learned previously as Winslow come over to the table. They introduce themselves. And so introductions, both real and false, are exchanged. Winslow, the editor of the local newspaper, is somewhat perplexed, positive that he's seen Steele, a.k.a. Professor Hildebrand.
Yeah.
He's seen him somewhere before. And in fact, he's pretty sure it was on a picture from the regional newswire. And Laura tries to misdirect the recognition with a story about how Professor Hildebrand is always giving important speeches. But the conversation
she's not wrong in a sense. Well, important is debatable.
Yes. But the conversation's already off to a shaky start, and it gets worse as well. Winslow fairly threatens them, warning them not to ask any questions, saying, people up here may get the wrong idea. They think you're prying into their personal affairs.
Dude, don't sit there going, don't ask questions, get out of our, like, this is making it worse for you. All of this is making it worse for them. If they were a friendly and accommodating and kept to their story about, yeah, he went to Bishop, Laura and Steele might have left if they found nothing, right? But instead, they're like, get out of our town. We don't want you here. Don't ask questions. There's nothing going on here. Why are you suspicious? Like, what?
I know. Not exactly the sharpest tools in the shed.
They're not good at this. They're really bad.
Well, the mayor does try to blunt Winslow's threat, saying that Donatites? Yes.
Donatians? I would...
Anyway, they treasure their privacy, and they, they like their own life the way it is, and they don't want it disturbed. Laura holds up the picture, saying that they don't mean to be a nuisance, but perhaps they've seen the man that they're looking for. And of course, again, neither Winslow nor the mayor look at the picture. And instead, Winslow harshly responds that the sheriff told them that the man went to Bishop. The mayor suggests that, well, maybe it'd probably be best for all concerned if Laura and Steele did the same thing. Anyway, not taking the hint, Laura, who for the most part of the second season couldn't recognize the threat if it was wearing a sign, recognizes the threatening tone in the mayor's voice. But the mayor insists, what would give you the idea we were being threatening? No. We weren't doing that at all.
Yeah.
So as the mayor tries to pretend that her threat wasn't a threat, the young waitress runs out the back door. Laura sees this. And of course, she's been sneezing their entire time while she's been in Donata. She sneezes again and then uses this as an excuse to go get some tissue, but instead follows the young woman out the back door as Winslow continues to insist that he's sure he's seen Steele somewhere before. Out back, Laura goes to the young woman who's clearly crying and upset. She confronts the woman who repeatedly insists that Laura and Steele shouldn't be there and that they should leave. The woman is afraid that someone will see them talking, insisting that talking to them and being there is just going to make things worse for him, which is obviously a reference to the professor, even though she doesn't say him by name. She says that he's a nice little man who wouldn't hurt anybody and who wouldn't even care about the money, but they need to go away. It's like, oh, new fact, money. There's money involved.
I don't know. The Rachel thing is the only part of this that doesn't feel like it fits because... Mm. Like, aside from Winslow, who we find out later is willing to kill over their secret, mm-hmm. everybody else in the town seems to be, like, just people trying to protect their secret. And, yeah, they've got him locked up in the jail, but there's no indication that, well, aside from the guys with the shotguns, that any of them are, I don't know, it just, she...
Well... I was going to say, in reference to the guys with the shotgun, it could be that Rachel knows enough about the various residents of the town that she realizes that some of them may step over the line if things get too close, if they feel that their secret is being threatened.
Then she goes and mentions the money, though. Like...
Well, but I mean, they haven't done anything yet, but yeah. She may know that they're the kind of people who would do something. So I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. To me, this is the only issue that I like this episode. I actually think mm-hmm. it's quite a bit of fun, but like, it just feels like she makes it feel more dangerous than it is. Because when we mm-hmm. do find Thicket, he's perfectly fine. He's just chilling out in the jail waiting for, like, they're literally just waiting for the timer to run out. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
They don't really have any incentive to kill anybody, really, unless they continue to act so suspicious that Laura and Steele stick around. Like. Yeah.
Well, there's that too. Yes. So anyway, when Rachel says that they need to go away, Laura forcefully says that she can't do that. The girl finally agrees to meet with them later at the Old Mill Bridge after she gets off work at 3:00. Conversation is interrupted by the mayor, who's come out and overheard the last part of the conversation. She asks the woman, Rachel, if everything is all right, and with a look of desperation mixed with concern, that look disappears and it's replaced by fear. And Laura insists that, well, you know, she's simply borrowing some tissue from the young woman who leaves and goes back into work. And of course, the mayor gives Laura a really cold, hard stare, like, I know you're up to something, but I don't know what it is, but you better not do it. So then Laura and Steele leave the diner, Steele complaining that he tried the beef.
He tried the beef.
Laura asks if he wants to stand by his earlier insistence on viewing Donata as an all-American town. He admits that it's starting to feel like a bad day at Black Rock, wherein Spencer Tracy gets trapped in a small town hiding a horrible secret. What's the secret? The town killed an innocent man. Laura suggests that they call Mildred to see what she knows or can find out about Thicket. Back at the office, Mildred is reading The Romance of the Wind. Note, it is not a Charlotte Knight book.
Does this woman ever do any work?
Apparently not.
I want her job. I said it before. I'll say it again. I want her job. She's constantly taking 2-hour lunches to go on a date. She just sits, like, she's reading The Dark Prince. She's reading Charlotte Knight. Now she's... I looked this up, by the way. Could not find this novel.
I did, too.
Feeling.
See, here's... I couldn't find the book by title. I could not find the author. And from the cover art, it appears that it's supposed to be probably an older historical romance or historical fiction. But, yeah, no such evidence of book or author. So
yeah, does she ever do any work?
No.
She's got a pretty good gig, I'd say.
She's just there in case something happens, you know.
Yeah, well, and presumably to make appointments and things like that, but yeah. I guess nobody's calling.
Apparently not. So somebody is now calling. Laura's calling. So Mildred answers. Mildred says she's eagerly been waiting their call. And is the boss there? She's got something for him. Annoyed, Laura reminds Mildred that Mr. Steele may be the boss, but I'm in charge. Do we really have to go through this every... Mildred apologizes, admitting that it's more force of habit.
Yeah.
Mildred says that Arthur Thicket sent his sister a letter from Donata 4 days ago. It just arrived that morning, and she brought it right over, and guess what it says? Well, Laura's not interested in playing 20 questions, much to Mildred's disappointment.
I know, she really wants her to guess. She's got really nothing else to do. She's that bored.
You got to play games anytime you can find them. Anyway, as Mildred begins to tell Laura about the contents of the letter, the line goes dead. And curiously, they both hear the same message. All phone lines to Los Angeles are temporarily out of order. Please try later.
Could the whole town do that? Would they be capable of cutting the line specifically just to L.A.?
No, not necessarily. But they've got a manual switchboard, so they could disconnect the call.
Okay.
And all the calls would come in through the switchboard, so they would see probably the area that it's coming from, and they could just not answer any calls from Los Angeles.
Gotcha.
But the thing is that both parties on that wouldn't have heard that message unless both parties were still connected to the operator there at Donata. So,
yeah.
Anyway, Mildred's distressed. Laura's disgusted. And, of course, then we see in the phone office, the operator turns to the sheriff, who gives her a good job nod. Next, we see Laura and Steele driving through the countryside. Laura is still sneezing, and apparently the combination of her hay fever and the case is getting on her nerves. When Steele suggests that she really ought to do something about the sneezing and the hay fever, she gives a snarky reply. When he asks if Rachel told Laura where the old mill bridge is, she sarcastically responds that no, she didn't, but it should be near a stream, don't you think? Wow. So Steele wisely backs off as Laura sneezes again. Back at the sheriff's office, Winslow is heading up a complaint committee made up of the gaggle of townsfolk who we've seen hostile to Steele and Laura. Throwing a photo of Steele down on the sheriff's desk, he announces that he knew that he'd seen the man in the photo. He's Remington Steele, big-time detective from L.A. And, of course, this news causes a stir of concern amongst those present. The sheriff, attempting to be the voice of reason, put that in sarcasm quotes, I think. I mean, how can you be reasonable if you're involved in a criminal conspiracy? But anyway, he urges everybody to stay calm, saying that the visitors haven't found anything and they've got less than 24 hours to go. But Winslow is not to be calmed, insisting that it's still too much time and they could call someone.
Didn't they just cut the phone lines, though?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Winslow apparently doesn't understand that all the phone calls go through this one switchboard and they've got an operator there to prevent the calls.
Yeah, they got that covered. Like,
yeah. Anyway, the mayor, who's also trying to pretend to be the voice of reason, tries to calm everybody, saying that, you know, it's okay. And then she asks sheriff what they should do to deal with the problem. And he shakes his head, admitting that he's not sure. And that doesn't go over well with Winslow. He just shouts, well, that's great, sheriff. That's just great. We're supposed to sacrifice 7 years of planning because you're not sure. And of course, the sheriff's had it with Winslow and says so in no uncertain terms. And then one of the others who's been holding the shotgun pumps the action and in a menacing voice says, he knows something that'll work. Guaranteed.
There's always one. There's always one in a town, right? Like there's always.
Well, you know, and the sheriff looks at him, but he doesn't say anything. He doesn't tell him no.
That's true.
He just looks at him and just kind of, I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that. Anyway, we're back at the office. Mildred is obviously upset. It seems like she's been trying to get through to Donata for an hour, and all she's getting is the proverbial runaround. She slams the phone down on the desk in disgust one last time and then looks down at a map on her desk. There, circled on the map, is a location. Next to the circle is an arrow pointing to it. Next to the arrow is the name Donata. Except it isn't.
Nope.
It appears to be in an area north of Willow Springs, southwest of Reefer City, at an intersection of Tehachapi Willow Springs Road and Bacchus Road. How's that for detail?
that's excellent. I didn't know. So I did see that, but what I found was kind of cool was that while there is no Donata, there is a La Canada, or Canada, one might say, which is in Flint Ridge, California. Yeah. So La Canada Flint Ridge, commonly known as La Canada, Spanish for the canyon, is a city in the foothills of the Verdugo Mountains in Los Angeles County, California, United States. So it's roughly within the distance. It's not the right like direction, but I just thought it was kind of cool that there's no Donata, but there's a Canada, and it's spelt Canada. It's in the western edge of the San Gabriel Valley in the location of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have tacos, but we have burritos. That's almost the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, we see Steele and Laura driving around looking for the old mill bridge. Still, apparently they haven't found it. Steele notices a truck some distance behind and asks how long it's been following them. And Laura glances at the mirror at the truck and answers, no, she hadn't noticed it, but she doesn't know how long it's been there. She obviously hasn't been paying attention. So, yeah.
Well, to be fair, that truck, I don't think, had been following them for very long when Steele noticed it. So,
well, might be, but, you know, she's driving. She would be the one looking in the mirror more frequently than Steele would be.
And yeah.
So she should have seen it before then. We're back to Laura being a little bit dense. Anyway, Steele predicts that they're about to have company. And as he's saying that, the truck accelerates and begins to overtake the rabbit. Steele urges Laura to pick up the pace and then, receiving no response, restates his urging. And Laura hollers that it's on the floor. While the truck continues to race forward, then slams into the back of the rabbit. Laura executes a quick spin turn, then begins heading back the opposite direction past their adversary.
That poor car. She's probably got her mechanic on speed dial at this point. Right?
She calls her insurance agent.
Like, what did you... Yeah, what did you do now? Like, how are you?
Yeah, well, you know, I've got the theory that the only thing left original on that car are the tires. Everything else has been replaced.
It's got to be every... It's like every other week it's in the shop, you know, bullet holes. Yeah.
So anyway, they're headed the opposite direction past their adversary. The driver of the truck stops, turns around, and then resumes the pursuit. Steele is impressed with the maneuver that Laura has pulled, asking where she learned to do that. And she reminds him that she's a city girl, describing the maneuver as a basic survival skill in Los Angeles.
He's seen how she drives. I'm not sure why he's surprised.
No, he shouldn't be. Anyway, the truck again approaches from behind and then again overtakes. And as the truck passes the man in the passenger seat, the man with the shotgun that we saw earlier, he leans out the window and shouts that they don't want no detectives up here, and then fires at Laura and Steele. Fortunately, it seems that the man couldn't hit the broadside of a barn from the inside. Either that or he
got
only...
the aim of a stormtrooper.
Yeah. Either that or he only intended to scare them, not actually shoot them, since he completely missed, which is good for them.
Yeah,
good for the show, I guess.
Honestly, I think he was trying to scare them. I think this is the red herring that the episode gives us to make us think that they're the ones that are willing to kill to keep the secret, but they seem more interested in just sort of like intimidating them and getting rid of them. Like they probably could have run them off the road or legitimately hurt them if they'd wanted to, but they didn't.
So. Yeah. So anyway, after having delivered their message, the men in the truck back off a short distance, but they are still in pursuit. Laura turns off the main road and the chase continues down various dirt roads until the pair of vehicle is approaching what appears to be something of a park with a river and a covered bridge. The truck is doing a bit of bump and run on the rabbit, and as they approach the river, the truck peels off, headed for the bridge, but Laura and Steele don't quite make it. Bad news is that they end up driving into the river. The good news is that they found the old mill bridge.
The rabbit goes for a swim.
Yes. And rabbits do swim. just
This one's not supposed to, though.
Anyway, as they walk out of the river onto the bank, Laura observes that they are there on time, but no Rachel. Steele corrects her, pointing to the lifeless figure hidden in the bushes nearby. Then we jump forward a little bit. We're back at the sheriff's office, and Laura and Steele are angry. It seems the sheriff refuses to consider Rachel's death as nothing more than an accident. Steele asks if the sheriff is really just saying that Rachel slipped on a rock and hit her head and just happened to crawl into the bushes to die. And the sheriff continues to play dumb, insisting that until he hears a better explanation, that's what he's sticking with.
So does he actually believe it was an accident, though? Because later on, they all seem pretty surprised that anybody would hurt Rachel. Like,
I think he believes it's an accident because that's the only thing he wants to see. And so he's not looking for anything else. You know, if he was being objective, he might ask some questions, but he has a vested interest in it not being murder.
Yeah, it might be similar to Steele's blinders of small town America. This is him, you know. Plus, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess there's not a lot of murders in Donata. So
well,
he's
probably not
come across this before.
Yeah, probably not. Well, anyway, the sheriff continues to play dumb, insisting that until he hears a better explanation, he's sticking with his theory. And then he claims that all that matters are facts. And never mind the fact that Rachel was supposed to meet with Laura and Steele at 3. Never mind the fact that Rachel was going to tell them something about Arthur Thicket. The sheriff claims that he doesn't know anything about that or why anyone would have a motive for murder. Really? You don't know? Okay. Yeah. So when Steele asks about the fact that the two gentlemen with the shotgun who ran them off the road, the sheriff claims he doesn't see any sort of connection. And Steele makes the rude comment about the sheriff's eyesight.
Yeah, that's a good line, though. Like,
Yes, it is.
He's definitely not under any illusion about small-town-friendly sheriff at this point.
No, he's not. But Laura tells Professor Hildebrand that they probably shouldn't bother the sheriff anymore since he's obviously a busy man.
Yeah.
Laura leads Steele out of the office, and when they're on the street, she tells him that they've got to get out of that town because they're all in on it. Well, Steele still thinks that Laura's being just a bit paranoid, but she asks him to think about what the man with the shotgun said. Steele offhandedly says he said something about not wanting detectives around, and then he suddenly realized what he said. How did they know they were detectives?
The penny drops.
Yay! Or nowadays it would be the quarter, 50 cent piece.
The loony drops.
Yeah. Laura surmises that somebody must have been listening in on their phone call with Mildred. After a moment, it dawns on Steele that it would be likely to be the sheriff. Laura points out that it wasn't just the sheriff, it's all of them, reminding Steele that everyone that they've met has tried to scare them out of Donata. The whole town is covering up something, and they're willing to kill to keep it a secret. Steele muses that bad day at Donata doesn't seem to make it. Of course, it would work if he sang it to a different movie.
Oh.
We're off on the road to Donata. Your driving is tough on the spine.
See, you are singing. You did sing.
No, I didn't. No, yep. That's just optical delusion.
Yeah, you did.
Anyway, Laura concludes that Thicket must have discovered their secret, or at least come very close, and that Rachel had said something about money. Steele suggests that they would probably be better off pondering the possibilities of the puzzle back at the office. Except that they're not going anywhere for at least a couple of days. The man from the gas station is pulling their car out of the river and tells them that he may have to send for parts. Of course, he's got to figure out what's wrong with the car first. I wouldn't have thought that would be too difficult. It's been drowned in a river.
It's in a pond. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
Your engine's flooded, firstly.
Anyway, when Steele asks...
And this is a weird sort of change of tactic, because initially they didn't want them in the town at all, and now they're like, you're not allowed to leave. And at this point, they don't know anything. So it really would be in their best interest to let them go back to L.A., because, like, Mildred, she hasn't shown up yet with the letter, right? So if they were to drive back to L.A., and do whatever it is they do there, there's every chance they would not figure out anything about the plane crash, the money, what have you, until the the timeline had passed. So I think it's kind of odd that they're suddenly doing this turnaround of, we're not going to be able to get the parts. And this is
except for a couple of things. First of all, what the man is saying is probably legitimate. There's probably going to be parts that need to be replaced, or at least, the thing's going to have to be disassembled and cleaned out. And that's going to entail replacing some parts, simply because there's some parts that once you take them off, you really need to replace them. So that part's probably legitimate. The other part, though, that may be more concerning to them is that if they let them go, they might figure out the story. And even though it would be after the fact that they knew about it beforehand, before the time expired, might put them in a questionable legal position. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
So I was going to put this somewhere in the episode, so we might as well talk about it here, because
the elephant in the room.
Well, see, to my knowledge, and I could be wrong because I'm not an expert on Canadian law by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think we have any or as many laws that have statutes of limitations. Like, I don't think that's as much of a thing here as it is in the US. And statutes of limitations are always somewhat bizarre to me, in the sense that the thing doesn't cease to be a crime just because X many years have gone by, right? So like, I don't get how suddenly, 7 years go by, cool, that bank robbery, it's totally fine now, you're not going to be punished. Like, that's, it's weird. So my question, and going to what you just said, like, they knew about it, they had the money for 7 years, regardless of whether or not they spent it, they had it. So, and granted, they didn't steal it, but there would be some law, I'm assuming, that required them to return it should they find it, or?
Yeah, I'm thinking that if they had found the money after the 7 years, which I think is the story that they're going to give, or that they're planning to give.
Obviously, yeah.
Then if they find it after the 7 years, they're not obligated to give it back. But if they had known about it prior to that 7 years of the statute of limitations, and they kept it and didn't say anything about it, they didn't turn it into the authorities, then I would think, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that would constitute being an accessory after the fact.
So that,
now, that is a crime, and that would be a crime that they are committing up to the day that the statute of limitations for the original crime expires, because it's an ongoing crime.
So then they're terrible at keeping this secret, because they make this grave and they put like the dedication on the grave.
But it's very enigmatic. It's enigmatic. Nobody knows really what it means.
Or, it's like if you're trying to hide it and pretend, if you're going to do what you said, and I think you're right that they're planning on claiming, oh, look, here's this money that we just found. What a crazy random happenstance that it would be a better idea to just bury the dead pilots with no grave, no marker, nothing. And okay, yes, the cockpit diner, that's rather clever. But like the rest of it, I think if you just buried them without any trace, you've got nothing linking you to the fact that it crashed there.
But they are good, upstanding people who feel like they owe the respect to these men of burying them proper.
So stick the grave after. Like, wait the 7 years, put the marker up afterwards. You're good to go. Because, oh, look, we found the money. And, oh, look, we found the pilots. Some kind soul buried them. I don't know who it was, but look, we'll put a little marker there. We'll thank them. It's all good. Like,
yeah,
they're not thinking this through. This crime, this is how I would do it.
they're not thinking this through. That is for sure. That is for sure.
And again, if there's any expert, I'm curious, because I don't want to look it up, take any more time, but if there's anybody that knows whether or not statutes of limitations like that exist here in Canada and any of the countries or the provinces or Canada. Territories, I would love to know, because I don't think we have that here. Like, I've never heard of there's a statute of limitations on this and now it's not a crime. It's very strange to me. But they're not very good at this, is all I'm saying.
So anyway, Steele asks if the man can't do the repairs any faster, and the man replies that this is not a young man, not Los Angeles. We do things our own way here. And of course, there's no place in town for Laura and Steele to rent a car, because this is Donata. And we do our own thing, our own way here. And then just then, a white Auburn speedster goes flying by and my dogs are going nuts. I don't know. Somebody just walked down the street. Anyway,
this is the first time that I've actually heard them when you said your dogs are going nuts, because I almost never hear them. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure, but I can hear them.
So anyway, the Auburn goes flying past with a motor officer in hot pursuit. Mildred is in the sheriff's office. Later, we see her there. And the sheriff asks if she can explain why she was, you know, as a perfectly self-respecting woman like herself, was traveling 75 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone.
Holy, okay, so yeah. I don't know about you, but here, something like that would get you a stunt driving charge. You'd have your license taken away.
Well, I don't know how they do it in California. Different states do it differently. Sometimes it's just a hefty fine based, you know, it's graduated based on how much over the speed limit you were going. Sometimes it's also points.
Yeah, we have points as well. Yeah.
Yeah. At some point, it turns into reckless driving or reckless endangerment or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say it's 75 in a 30 zone. That would probably, get her in some serious trouble with her driver's license.
I have a funny story. I once got a ticket for not wearing my seatbelt. Yeah. $250 fine, as it turns out. So wear your seatbelt, kids. But I, at the time that it happened, I had just graduated teacher's college and I had a mountain of student debt and I had no way of paying this $200 because you had to pay it within, I think it was 10 days, right?
Mm.
So with a ticket like that, you have three options. You can plead guilty and just pay the ticket. You can plead not guilty and try to fight it, which sometimes could involve a lawyer and whatever else. Or you can plead guilty with an excuse and go before a judge and basically say, like, yes, I did the thing. Can you please either give me more time or lower the fine or whatever, right? So
because I had a good reason for it.
Well, this is the thing. So I got to tell a funny story. So this is the thing. I went to the court intending to plead guilty with an excuse. And I'm sitting there and I'm watching the judge see case after case after case similar to mine where everyone tried to give an excuse. And the judge, this guy was not having it. He didn't care about your excuses. And this one woman who had been fined for doing 80 and a 50. Okay. And we're talking kilometers. So she was basically doing highway speeds in a residential area. And she went before the judge to plead guilty with an excuse. Her excuse? She was following a fire truck and she was going with the flow of traffic. He was not sympathetic to her excuse.
We are not amused.
Funnily enough, I was the only one that the judge actually lowered my fine and gave me extra time to pay. Because when I finally got up in front of him, I learned my lesson from everyone that came before me. And when he said, I did it. Well, I said, what's your excuse? I said, I don't have the money. Like, I've brought my bank statements. You can see how much I've got. I don't have the money. And he asked, you know, what I did. And I explained my student debt and blah, blah, blah. And he said, so you're trying to make your life better. And you did do this. So you do have to be fined. And I was like, yes, sir, you're 100% correct. So he lowered my fine down to $150 and gave me 4 months to pay for it. So I was like,
but how much did you actually wind up having to pay though?
I paid the $150.
Yeah. Okay. So
he left it
here.
Yeah.
Here in the States, the enlightened United States, you get a traffic fine for speeding. Let's say it's $250. That was what your ticket was, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then there's a processing fee on top of that.
Oh.
And then there's at least two fees on top of every ticket that you pay. And so a simple $250 ticket will wind up costing you maybe close to $500.
Oh, geez. No, I paid $150.
Yeah. Now, because you got paid processing fee, like money acceptance fee, or, you know.
Oh, that's ridiculous. That's a day that ends in Y fee. Like, come on.
that's pretty much it. Yeah. And it's like, no, that's not what the ticket says. No. Yeah. It's like if you you were to go to a restaurant and order something and they say, yeah, well, and you've got the sales tax, and then we've got to charge you for accepting your money, and then we got to charge you for handing you the change back, yeah. And then we got to charge you for handing your merchandise to you. Yeah, it's just ridiculous.
Like when you buy tickets to a concert and they charge you a processing fee on your tickets. You're like, do what? You did nothing. Just anyway.
Well, you know, the one that's most insulting on that is when you go to the ticket office.
Yes.
And they charge you an additional fee because, well, it's a handling fee. Well, no, a handling fee is when a third party sells it. Yeah. You're not a third party. You're the ticket office. Anyway, sorry. Getting wound up.
Yeah. So Melvin should get a reckless driving charge here. That was quite the speech.
Yes. Anyway.
I didn't even know the Auburn could go that fast, but. Well, here we are.
There we are. Mildred commends the sheriff for his attitude, saying that, you know, most government employees wouldn't be so polite as he seems to be being. Of course, she doesn't realize that he's not a trustworthy officer of the law.
Doing a good job sucking up here, I gotta say.
And she tells him that she works for the Remington Steele Detective Agency and that Mr. Steele and his associate, Miss Holt, are working on a case right here in Nevada. And that she received a letter that contains very important information for her boss. And she tried calling from Los Angeles, but all their phone lines are out of order. You know, you really should do something about that. And so that's why she was speeding. Her boss needs to see this right away. And of course, the sheriff. Okay.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Has she read the letter?
Oh, yeah. Because that's what she was trying to tell them on the phone call. Is that she'd read the letter.
So what's in it? I got to know what's in it, because it obviously can't have anything in it that implicates everybody in the town, or Mildred wouldn't be freely giving this information away. So presumably whatever's in the letter is maybe not as incriminating as Jed Nebbins takes it to be. I would think that when he puts her in the jail cell, like usually when you're put in a cell, your stuff is taken from you, right? Like your purse, whatever, like, I would think it would have been smart if he had looked at the letter to see what was actually in it before putting her in a cell with Arthur Thicket.
Well, that would be improper, because that's a personal letter addressed to somebody else. And it's just not right to read somebody else's mail. These people are a curious mix of
innocent and stupid.
Well, of morally upright and morally totally beyond
morally
redemption.
Bankrupt. Well, yes. They're operating in this very gray area where they didn't steal the money. It's kind of like you find $20 on the street and you see somebody in front of you that probably just dropped it. You've got the option of A, chasing after them and saying, hey, I think this is yours. Or B, just being like, well, I didn't see it. It's mine now. So I think that's their like way of justifying what they're doing, because they're like, well, we didn't steal the money.
Yeah.
But we're sure as heck going to keep it.
Really. Finders keepers, losers weepers.
Yeah.
Anyway, the sheriff, pretending to be upstanding and uncorrupted and uncorruptible, gives her a pretentious and very hypocritical speech about how, in the eyes of the law, that's no excuse for the serious nature of her offense, as she was recklessly endangering the citizens of Donata, who he has sworn to protect. And he tells her the fine is $500 or the weekend
that's
in jail.
That's a heck of a fine. In 1984, your gas is $5.
Well, we find out how he can get away with it later, because he's also the magistrate, which raises a serious question about conflict of interest.
Right?
Yeah. So anyway.
Ethics?
Yeah. And thank you to whoever it was who bought that coffee mug, by the way. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyway, we get a quick shot of Lauren Steele in the front of the tow truck, very frustrated at the slow pace of their progress back to town. And then we see Mildred counting out money to pay the fine. 100, 200, 300, 400, 420, 440. Oh, a traveler's check for $50. That makes it 490. Sorry, you're $10 short. Don't I get a discount for cash? Nope. And of course, then she remembers she's got money stashed in her shoe. Phew. Anyway, there you go. Sawbuck, 500 even. And she sarcastically says, thank you very much. And begins heading out the door. Not quite so fast. You've also violated local law number 15-3-8, disturbing the peace with a motorized vehicle. I think by this point.
I think he made that up.
But, By this point, Mildred has realized she is dealing with a bent lawman who is not only a jerk, but has probably started making stuff up. And that there is no
$500.
And she already knows what the fine is. $500. So anyways, the sheriff takes Mildred back to the cells. She threatens that he hasn't heard the last of her, and the sheriff agrees that he probably hasn't, but she'd better make herself comfortable. And after a moment, she begins looking around and realizes that she's not alone in the cell. The other tenant is their missing professor, Arthur Thicket. Wait a second. He put a man and a woman in the same cell over the weekend.
I don't see a toilet in there either, so.
Well, yeah, it's obviously not meant to be used for more than just a few hours at a time. And even if there was, I mean, it still raises some serious questions.
Well, I mean, yeah, it does. Well, to be fair, the other cell is inhabited by the money that decided to hide in the... What? These people are terrible at keeping this secret.
For some reason, and I haven't been able to place it, that whole thing about money being in... It's got to be a Maverick episode. Money being... covered in a tarp in a jail cell. It is so familiar to me. I know I've seen it somewhere else before, but I can't place it. If anybody knows, shout out and let us know. So anyway, at the sheriff's office, Laura and Remington confront the sheriff about Mildred. Sheriff reveals that he knows their true identity, and Laura and Steele insist that they're taking Mildred and leaving. But sheriff says, no, Mildred can't go because she can't make bail. Steele says, fine, he'll cover it. But that's going to be a problem because the magistrate's office is closed and it won't be open again until Monday morning at 9 o'clock. And Steele says, fine, we'll speak to the magistrate. Sheriff says, you're looking at him. Yeah. So either he's lying about being both the sheriff and the judge, which is what magistrate is.
I think he's totally lying.
Or there is a very serious ethical and corruption and legal problem going on in Denial because this is a serious conflict of interest.
Yeah. I'm assuming that the magistrate is probably not even in the town. Like, it's such a small community that it's probably covered by, like, a larger municipality. And
they just defer everything to the county level.
Yeah. Whatever it is, he's probably like, yeah, I'm the magistrate. Like, how are they going to challenge that? They can't even leave the town at this point. So.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Because Laura then says that, well, we'll see you in court, but he hits them with one more bit of trouble that he's intent to make. They can't leave with the Auburn. They can't take it. It's impounded as evidence. And just to make sure nobody gets any ideas, he's removed the distributor cap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's covered most of his bases pretty well, actually.
Except the big flashing sign over his head that said, I'm guilty of stuff. Like, if the Great Kirk Corporation is the company that gets stuff done.
That's exactly where I was going. The sheriff, Donata, sheriff who does stuff,
Donata, the town that is guilty of stuff. Like, they're not doing a great job. No. That's all I'm saying.
Then we jump forward. It's night. We see Mildred and the professor talking in their apparently co-ed cell. The scene begins mid-conversation with the professor telling her that he was reinforcing his thesis with supporting documentation from their library when the lights went out. And, well, you know the rest. Of course, we don't. Mildred expresses her supposed disbelief at the story, except, of course, she believes it. The professor agrees that it does beg credulity, that is to be sure. Which was why he spent so much time cross-checking the details, but the townspeople said that they didn't know anything about it. Not the graves or anything. And Mildred, of course, sums up the conclusion with her usual characteristics of pretending to be a tough-talking detective in a pig's eye. Why else would they have thrown you in this slammer, the lousy screws?
I love it when she does this. This is the best. I love it when Mildred, like, decides to be Dirty Harry or whatever, like the dirty screws, like...
Mildred announces that no one's going to keep them in stir when they've got a story to tell like this. So she grabs a coffee cup and begins banging it across the bars, hollering, let us out, you dirty screws.
Oh, Mildred.
And when the professor asks what she's doing, she informs him that she saw this once in a James Cagney movie. So the professor grabs a cup and joins her in banging on the bars of their jail cell. Then at the back of the cell, Laura appears through the barred windows, obviously hanging from the roof, and shushes them, saying they'll wake the entire town. And Mildred greets her, and Laura, of course, recognizes the professor and greets him. Mildred asks what Laura is doing there, and Laura declares, "We've come to rescue you." I've always wanted to say that. And then she disappears. I think they should have made a reference to, aren't you a little short for a stormtrooper or something like that? But anyway,
yeah.
We jump to the roof where we see Remington has been holding on to her. She tells him that the professor is there with Mildred, and he asks, shouldn't we get on with it? And then confesses that this is the first time he's ever broken into a jail.
This is, I like that. Which, because it implies he's broken out.
Yes. Probably has.
Love to know the background of that.
They move over to a vent, which is conveniently on the roof, conveniently large enough to let a person pass through, and conveniently drops straight down into the jail with apparently no other purpose than to let somebody drop through.
Well, so, to be fair, I don't think they've got many jailbreaks in Donata.
Well, yeah, but this isn't technically a jailbreak yet. It's a jailbreak-in.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. So, also, nobody's on guard duty.
Yeah.
There's nobody there guarding the prison or the prisoners.
Or the money. Like, or the money. Money that they're so intent on claiming after this time. Yeah. You'd think they'd have somebody there because they've put the two people, like Mildred and Arthur, in the cell next to it. Like,
yeah,
I'd really be looking after that money.
Yeah.
I don't know about you.
Anyway, Mildred is excited by the professor's story and urges him to tell Steele and Laura about it. But Steele suggests that, you know, it might be more prudent to get the keys and unlock the cell and get the two jailbirds out. This is curious. He goes to a nearby door and lets himself into the main area of the cell by picking the lock on the door. Shouldn't that door lock from the other side?
I thought that too. you shouldn't have a... Yeah.
I guess this is so that if the prisoners break out, they can lock the door to keep the cops from coming in to get them.
I suppose, yeah.
Anyway, as they're there waiting for Steele, Laura spots the sheet covering something in the next cell over. She reaches through the bars, pulls off the sheet, revealing the piles and piles of money. And, of course, Mildred, it's the money! She and the professor, you know, say that simultaneously, and Laura naturally asks, what money? From the Cleveland First City Bank. Laura grabs one of the bundles of money as Steele runs in, clearly disturbed, slams the door behind him, and orders Laura back up the vent as Mildred asks, what about us? Steele, sorry, have to take a rain check.
Gotta go. Bye.
As Laura is completing her climb, Steele notices the money in the adjacent cell and asks about it. And he's told, Cleveland First City Bank, armored car money. Now we're out on the outside of the building. Laura and Steele are on the roof. They lower themselves to the ground. And as they hit the ground, they see the town folks coming down the street, shouting, burning torches in hand, although apparently no pitchforks or tar and feathers.
I have a question with this. Do they not have flashlights? Because this seems to me like it would take a long time to get this ready, because you'd have to pass out a torch to everybody. You'd have to like have like a cloth draped around it that's like soaked in something so that the torch burns continuously and doesn't like burn. Like, they would have to have these prepared. Do they have, like, a stockpile of torches to burn? Should they need to chase somebody out of town? Like, in case you just grab a flashlight? Like,
well, flashlights aren't as menacing, you know?
No, but, like, this seems to be, like, there'd be some preparation involved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've had all afternoon, so.
That's true. Yeah.
No, it doesn't really quite make sense, but visually it's very dramatic.
And what are they planning to do when they catch them? Since put them, I assume, in the jail cell with Mildred? Like, they don't want them in town, but they don't want them leaving town, but they don't want them, like, it. At this point, I don't think they know what they want.
Yeah. What part of this don't you understand? It's pretty obvious.
I'm so confused.
Anyway, Laura and Steele see them. They take off running. The crowd spots them and takes off in pursuit. Steele and Laura split up, but as they take off their separate ways, Steele falls. The crowd sees him, but realizing that their quarry is split up and gone different directions, but not seeing Laura, they stop and pause, because that's what you do. When you're an angry crowd intent on burning your city down or burning people at the stake, you stop to give careful consideration to your plan of action.
Sure. I mean, I've definitely done that every time I've been part of an angry mob.
That's right.
Haven't you?
Yeah. Did it just last week, as a matter of fact.
It's Angry Mob 101. Like, it's in the pamphlet. The pamphlet you get at the beginning of the Angry Mob when you organize your torches and get your pitchforks ready.
Well, Laura from the other side has seen Steele's plight, and she gives out with a whistle to confuse the crowd long enough to give Steele a chance to get up to his feet and begin running again. Crowd splits up, some chasing Steele, some chasing Laura, and Laura hides, giving the group chasing her the slip. Unfortunately for her, her sneezing has not abated, and her location is revealed. She takes off running again, but finds herself in a rundown between second and third base. Two groups of townspeople.
Sure.
And as the townspeople are conveniently not taking hold of her, despite having her trapped, Steele appears riding a white horse. He rides up to her, grabs her, pulls her up on the horse, and they ride off into the night. Convenient.
Where did he get the horse?
Well, I was going to say, convenient that someone just happened to leave a horse sitting around with the keys in it.
Right. Or
the bridle on it, okay?
Yeah, ready to go. Like, it's saddled, it's
that's yeah. Well, no, and he's literally, I don't think, like, he had a saddle, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but
he's literally on a white horse, saving her on a white horse.
Yeah. Anyway, Laura and Remington, next we see them. They've seemed to have lost the angry crowd. They find themselves at a park. I don't think it's the same park, but it's another park similar. It's late at night. It's dark. It's cold. Steele suggests that they huddle. Laura gives him a doubtful look, but he assures her. For warmth, strictly for warmth. So they sit down and huddle, body to body, face to face. And after a moment, Steele asks with some concern if she's going to sneeze. She replies it's too cold to sneeze. And Steele, contrary to his previous declaration, apparently has more than mere warmth on his mind as he suggestively begins rhapsodizing about their surroundings and situation. The crisp night air, the open range, the solitary couple with nothing but murder, two innocent people, and a jail cell full of cash.
Well, and I mean, this is, again, like Jeff Melvoin wrote Steel's Gold, right? Mm-hmm. So similar circumstances in this. Yep. There's no sleeping bag involved, but he's never one to miss an opportunity. So,
yeah. And it's, again, it's Steele trying to be romantic and Laura, who just pulls him right out of by focusing on reality.
To be fair. Even yes. If he'd gotten what he wanted and they start, you know, having intimate relations, would you want to do that sort of thing out there in the desert with, I'm sorry, sand gets in all sorts of places and there's not anything romantic or appealing about that situation. I would just like, not that I would ever know, but I'm imagining, because if you go to the beach, right, and you come back, even though you've got a bathing suit on,
oh,
you
yeah.
bring the beach with you, right? Like, you track so much sand. I can only imagine, from Laura's perspective, how unappealing that would be. And that's all I'm going to say about it, but yeah.
But you have no experience in this matter.
Oh, God, no. That would be, no thanks.
At least none that you're admitting to. Anyway, she pulled out the bundle of money she snagged earlier and begins examining it. And frustrated in his attempt at wooing her, Steele sarcastically commends her resourcefulness. Laura begins pondering the bundle and the band holding the bundle together. Cleveland First City Bank, 1977. This money's 7 years old. $100 bills, and there were stacks of 20s and 50s as well. It must be over $1 million back there. Steele suggests that it's probably more like millions of dollars, several millions of dollars. And then he asks what it was that Mildred and the professor had said about an armored car robbery. Suddenly, the key turns in Laura's mind, and the tumblers fall into place. 7 years ago, the Cleveland armored car robbery, $6 million. Two men in ski masks, never caught. A fortune from a seven-year-old robbery is locked up, untouched, in a jail cell in Donata. Unbelievable, but what's it doing here, she asks. Then the conversation takes a turn to the personal. Laura thanks him for saving her, and he says he was just returning the favor and leans in to kiss her. And it's starting to look like Steele's romantic notions may yet have opportunity to be satisfied. But
nope.
No, Laura's back to contemplating the money.
She's go right back to the dock and the fax out.
That's right.
He just kind of gives up. He's like, all right, I'm going to bed.
Yeah. Leans back and closes his eyes. And the next thing, it's morning. Laura's still awake contemplating the case. Why would they kill Rachel and only hold Arthur Thicket? It doesn't make sense. She sneezes, waking up Steele. And, of course, he wakes up stiff and cold from their awkward sleeping and sitting position. The two of them get up on their feet and begin to stretch. But Steele spots something in the distance, something disturbingly suggestive. Two mounds of dirt, less than 2 feet wide, roughly 6 feet long, with crude crosses and a sign at one end. They walk over for a closer look. The crosses are made out of propeller blades, and the sign reads, "Unknown. Died February 28th, 1977. They have paid for their sins, and we are grateful."
They even dated it. Like, I just...
There you go. Exactly.
Propeller blade. Like, they used propeller blades to make...
That's not the...
Like,
that's not the date I thought you were referring to. Because... Like, when was this episode aired?
Oh, it was aired on February 28th, which I thought was really cool.
1984, exactly 7 years.
I thought that was really cool that they did that, because obviously it was kind of a wink too. But still, like, I just keep going back to how stupid it was to put a marker on it on the grave like that and draw attention to it. If you're trying to hide this money,
they just can't help but reveal to everybody how brilliant and smart and clever and such they are that they just keep giving themselves away. So, yes, Laura recognizes the date 7 years ago today. Steele is overtaken with excitement and declares, "Yes, yes, yes, it's all beginning to make sense now. I can see it. Or at least I think it does." And as they're walking away from the graves, Laura spots something in the grass. It's a wheel from an airplane. Steele picks it up, tucks it under his arm, and turns to Laura and proposes a scenario. You've just robbed an armored car with $6 million. The police have put up roadblocks. There's no place to run. But, Laura supplies, perhaps someplace to fly. And, of course, they begin imagining the scene. Something goes wrong, bad weather, engine trouble, something that brings them down in Donata. And so they paid for their sins, but the money was fine. They must have known.
Yeah, that's surprising. The whole plane crashed, but all the money survived.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's possible.
The engine was on fire. Like, you'd think that money made of paper would burn.
Well, except the money was in the fuselage of the airplane, not necessarily was that portion of the plane caught up in the fire when it crashed. I mean, it doesn't seem reasonable, but it's a possibility. So, anyway, they determined that the town must have known what the dead man and the money were. After all, the robbery had been a headline story for days, but it's hard to part with a fortune in cash, particularly if no one knows you've got it. So suppose they just put it in the jail, you know, just for safekeeping. And then eventually realized that no one outside of Donata ever knew about the accident. So they waited 7 years for the statute of limitations to expire. The money was traceable, but after 7 years, there would be no prosecution. And the 7 years are up today, and somehow Arthur Thicket stumbled onto all of this, so they put him on ice.
There was a wheel from the plane just sitting around, so they haven't even cleared away all the debris. And have they left the money in the jail cell for 7 years? Is it that safe, a town where there's been zero crime? Like... Or have they put it somewhere else?
Well, I would say they probably did clear up a bunch of the debris, because the cockpit of the airplane is on the front of the diner.
It's literally the diner, yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily found everything and picked up everything. So they probably just did most of it.
Have they had the money in the jail cell for 7 years? Because
sounds like it, yeah.
They've never had any opportunity to use those jail cells. I think maybe they need to re-examine where the budget for Donata goes, because clearly having a jail there is not necessary.
I'm going to say the money has been sitting there for 7 years, and nobody's... Maybe the only people that get arrested are locals, and since they're in on it, it's not a big deal. You know?
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, Otis comes in for the night, puts himself in the cell to sleep it off.
Yeah.
That's an Andy Griffith reference, folks.
Yeah, I know. They check his pockets as he leaves to make sure he hasn't decided to help himself.
Anyway, so as they're talking, Steele casually wonders what they did with the rest of the plane. And, of course, back in the town, as Laura and Remington watch the town folks gather at Cockpit Diner, last hot food for 40 miles, they realize that they've been looking at it the entire time, hidden in plain sight.
Yep.
See what I did there?
I see. This part is probably the only element of the whole situation that I think is slightly clever, to put the cockpit on the front facing part of the restaurant, because everyone would just think it was a gimmick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, and things like that have been done lots of times. There was a restaurant, or not a restaurant, I'm sorry. There was a gas station down in Portland area, that for many, 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 many years, and I don't know if it's still there or not, but they had a B-17 bomber from World War II mounted up on pedestals. And that was their awning, so to speak, covering the gas station.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
So, you know, stuff like that has been done. So, yeah, I think most people would just look at it and say, hey, isn't that clever? I've heard people buying old airplanes and turning them into homes or motor coaches or things like that. So, yeah.
I've seen that.
So anyway, inside the diner, everyone is watching the clock as the mayor congratulates them. She tells them that despite the previous night's excitement, which she didn't say she approved, well, which she won't say she approved of, as she carefully avoids saying she disapproved of it.
Yeah.
She says
she's a politician. She's politicking here.
Yes, that's right. As she says, for 7 years, they've hung together, resisting temptation, and in 10 minutes, they will have their rightful reward. The sheriff announces that he will be handing out everyone's shares alphabetically, so there's no need for pushing or shoving. But Winslow seems nervous, perhaps even sweating a bit more than is appropriate for a February morning.
Yeah. They all seem to be sweating more than is appropriate. I wonder if their clothing has... If any of them have clothing that doesn't have sweat stains on it, because like everybody seems to be just covered in it.
Yeah. Anyway, Laura, Steele, and Mildred are outside. They and the professor head for the sheriff's Jeep. Steele hotwires it. Everyone piles in, and they are headed out of Dodge or out of Donata.
So how did they intend to come back for the rabbit and the auburn? Like they seem pretty like, let's get out of here. Were they just going to leave their cars?
Well, I'm sure at some point they would come back and get them and maybe bring in some.
Fred go get them.
Maybe. No, but somebody would have to come with him. Maybe they're planning on bringing in the National Guard or somebody or you know, getting the state police involved and, you know, whatever. True. But they're making good progress on their escape. They're some distance out of town, but then the two truck bandits show up, and same guys who shot at them earlier. And this time they shoot at the window of the Jeep. They don't try to miss. They try to hit. And, of course, Steele loses control enough that they run off the road. Well, back at the sheriff's office, everyone is waiting for the final 3 minutes. But the two bad guys bring in our intrepid crew. Steele observes that it looks like they're getting ready to have quite a party. And, of course, the mayor apologizes for any inconveniences that they may have caused, but she's sure they can reach an amicable settlement.
Yeah, this is, again, politician bribery. Mm-hmm. You go hand in hand.
Corruption, yep. Yeah, Mildred sneers at the mayor and tells her, wow, fat chance. Winslow gloats, saying that there's nothing they can do because the statute of limitations is almost up, which is actually... I don't think the statute of limitations goes by the hour of the day. I think it's just based on the calendar day. I could be wrong.
I would assume so as well.
So I don't know why noon would be a magic number.
Well, because it's the Old West and we're doing high noon. Like this is what, silly
me.
Right. Of course. But yeah, I so definitely, obvious. He says there's no statute of limitations on Laura says there's no statute of limitations on murder. Why is there one on bank robbery? Like, this is where I had intended to raise the topic of statutes of limitations. But, like, I don't get it. Maybe someone can hopefully explain to me why there'd be a statute of limitations on a crime. Like, it doesn't cease to be a crime after 7 years. So,
I don't know. I think it has to do with timely prosecution and, you know, because in the U.S., one of the constitutional guarantees is right to a speedy trial. And arguably, if it's been 7 years since the crime, and also...
Right, but you have a right to a speedy trial once you've been arrested.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. It just... Yeah, there's things that where you would think that there would not be a statute of limitations, but there is, so... But, fair yeah, Laura makes the comment about statute of limitations on murder. One of the shotgun bros says, well, we didn't murder anybody. Not yet, anyway. And...
Not the sheriff, for lack of trying.
Yeah. The sheriff insists that they all agreed when this thing started, no one would get hurt, and no one has. But Steele, of course, rebuffs the sheriff, demanding he explain that to Rachel. And one of the shotgun bros doesn't like Steele's attitude, warning him to watch his mouth. That was my cousin you're talking about. And Laura insists that Rachel was murdered. Rachel's mother insists that she died from a fall. The sheriff said so. And as we all know, a lieman would never lie when there are millions of dollars at stake that they can lay their hands on if they do lie.
Of course not.
No, no, no. Nobody would ever do that. That would be dishonest.
Yeah.
Anyway, Steele declares that it's unlikely. Most people who fall forward on their heads don't end up on their back, the way we found Rachel. The mayor demands an answer from the sheriff, who's justification for ruling the girl's death is accidental because, you know, who'd want to kill her? Well, of course, that makes it accidental, right? Nobody'd want to kill her.
She's so nice. Who'd want to kill her?
That's right. So it couldn't have been. Laura says, well, it would have been somebody who wanted a piece of $6 million, which means it could be anybody in the room. Winslow stands up and hollers at the crowd. They're just trying to confuse us, make us give up the money. The two big-time detectives can't admit they've been outsmarted by a bunch of hicks. In 50 seconds, we're going to be millionaires. Don't let them talk you out of it.
My math is not great. I will freely admit this, but, and granted, we don't know how many of them are going to get a share of this money.
Mm-hmm. But they're not all
going to be millionaires. But unless it's only six, yeah. If there's $6 million, unless it's only six people that are getting the payout, none of them are going to be millionaires. So
no.
Winslow's comment of they think we're just a bunch of dumb hicks, he kind of proves his own point here.
I mean, because there's at least a dozen people there.
Yeah, at least.
You know, so
and they're going to get a decent amount of money for sure, but it's not going to be millions of dollars because there's only
$300,000-$400,000 a piece. Yeah, that's probably all
they get now. I'd wait 7 years for that. Sure.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, the professor is certain that they're going to get away with it, and Mildred is certain that they won't. And she urges Steele to play their ace, boss. Steele, in turn, urges Laura to play their ace. Well, Laura's got no ace up her sleeve, so she begins to bluff. Well, the fact that Rachel was found face down means she knew her... What? Oh, wait a minute. Stop. Steele just got done saying that she was found on her back. Now Laura's saying that she was found face down, which means that the killer knew, that she knew and trusted her killer. Nobody catches this contradiction, because basically... Laura has just proven that it wasn't murder. Well, Laura looks at the mayor when she's talking about this, saying, you know, Rachel knew her killer, trusted him or her. Laura points out that the mayor was the only one who overheard Rachel telling Laura that they were going to meet at the bridge. Well, the mayor doesn't deny it, but she says, well, I told the sheriff and I told Winslow about it. And, of course, Winslow starts to panic, urging everyone not to listen to them. Steele looks at him and asks him why he's so nervous. And then he grabs a bundle of bills and tosses it to Winslow, who catches it in his left hand. Then he tosses another one at the sheriff. He thanks them, saying that that catch has just caught a killer. It's as good as a signed confession. The injury on her... The injury was on her right temple, which means that whoever killed her was left-handed, assuming that they were standing in front of her, not behind her, but... You know, we're going to ignore that point.
Can I ask a question that's not really related to the topic of the episode?
But absolutely.
It has nothing to do with Buffy, I promise. But if you watch Steele's face here, does it seem to you that there's something wrong with one of the sides of his face? Like, he seems to be talking out of one side of his mouth that he doesn't usually do. And it looks like he might have had some swelling or something going on there that...
Mm. Yeah, you're right.
I don't know. I thought maybe somebody would know something about that. I looked in the book, but I didn't see anything. But yeah, he has kind of like he's talking out of one corner of his mouth in this scene.
I hadn't noticed it sort of way until you pointed it out, and then I just went and grabbed the video and looked at it. And yeah, you're right. Maybe he got punched in doing one of the stunts or something.
Or had some like allergic reaction to something or
toothache.
Anyway, yeah. Toothache could be, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so after Steele has his little spiel, Winslow, believing that Laura and Steele really know what they're talking about and assuming that he's been proven guilty, grabs the sheriff's gun from his holster and takes everyone hostage. He frantically tries to justify killing Rachel, saying that she was going to tell them. I couldn't talk her out of it. What did you want me to do? Spoil everything? 7 years. I was doing it for you. No, you weren't.
Okay.
No, all right, you dude, weren't. Sure. But, you know, hey, whenever you want to convince somebody that what you're doing that's sleazy is somehow okay, I'm doing it for you.
Oh, it's gaslighting 101, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's how you do it. So Laura shouts that money's covered in blood, and if any of them touches it, they're as guilty as Winslow. Well, he goes completely off the deep end, waving the gun around, warning everybody to get back, but he's moved just a bit too close to Laura, who hauls back and kicks the gun out of his hand, followed
that's
by
cool.
Yeah, she did that good. I mean, she's...
It's a cool moment, yeah.
I don't think it would probably have worked well in real life, but yeah, I mean, Stephanie did it well.
Yeah.
But yeah,
she did.
And then Steele punches Winslow in the face. The sheriff grabs him and then hauls him out. The mayor tells Steele and Laura that they, the townsfolk, owe them an apology. And Laura points to the money and says, you owe a lot more than that. As they begin to leave, Laura congratulates, in sarcasm quotes, Steele on his clever detective work about the left-hand, right-hand bit. And Steele proudly tucking the bundle of bills that he has in his hand under his arm. And not realizing he's being set up. Attributes the trick to the movie In the Heat of the Night, and Laura deviously points out that Rachel was hit on the left side of her head, not the right. Steele dismisses this as a mere technicality, telling her that she's always getting bogged down in technicalities. And as he finally begins to head out the door with the bundle of bills, Laura grabs it and returns it to the table. Back at the office, Steele is reading a newspaper with a headline that reads, Heist of the Decade Solved. Unusual Trail Ends in Small Town. Laura enters and comments on the remarkable story about the small town that just happened to find the money from the famous Cleveland arm robbery. And, you know, did they intend to keep it? No, they turned it over for a big reward. Oh, so virtuous of them. Yes, absolutely wonderful, kind-hearted people. Well, you know how upright those towns can be. Mildred enters wearing a mink coat. When Laura asks where she got it, Mildred responds, oh, this whole thing, it's gorgeous, isn't it? And after Steele and Laura both express admiration for it, Mildred tells them that it was a gift from Sheriff Nebbins.
Yeah,
and Laura.
Nice little bribe there.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not a bribe. It's not a bribe. It's a negotiation.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Laura somewhat disbelievingly asks, what, he gave it to you? And Mildred slyly comments that it's amazing what the words false arrest can do for a girl's wardrobe.
Well, I got to say, Mildred knows how to leverage sometimes.
That's right. Yes. Which is kind of funny because early on in the second season, she was a lot less...
Well, she was terrified in that episode where they drag her into the bank to try to. Now she has no problems. Like, that's if you think about My Fair Steel, where she's like, that's prime beef. Like, she, she's now fully in on it.
Yeah.
It's great.
And of course, if the false arrest thing didn't work, she always had her friends at the IRS.
I could have them. We can look into how your town's using their budget, and I can pretty much guarantee they'll see that jail cell doesn't need it to be there.
Not even the town. Just look at everybody individually. Just tear their taxes apart for, you know, the last 10 true. Years, whatever. Make their life miserable. Yeah. Because that's what we do at the IRS. We make your life miserable so that we can live in style. Anyway, the professor arrives, he's Mildred's lunch date, And as they leave, Laura comments that she never would have guessed that those two would get along so well, which actually, no, it doesn't surprise me.
Did she ever work a full day? She's just taking out, like, I'm going out. I have a date. Like,
sure, why not?
I don't think she has a schedule per se here. I think she just shows up when she wants and leaves when she wants. And honestly, I kind of want that job.
She works kind of like a lot of the small businesses in small towns or states without a large population like Alaska work. I mean, it's we open kind of at 9 o'clock, maybe 8:30, maybe 9:30, depending on when we get up and get here. We're going to take a lunch somewhere in the middle, you know, maybe an hour, maybe an hour and a half. We're going to close down sometime in the afternoon. Not sure exactly when, just whenever we think. It's called Alaska time. Anyway, it doesn't surprise me that Mildred and the professor would get along.
Oh, no.
That's all I'm saying.
They seem like they would get along like a house on fire. They're both coming from backgrounds where they love to look at the minutiae and like boring little details that the rest of us would just have no interest in whatsoever. So I would see that as a match made in heaven personally.
Yeah. Plus, they both got a great story to share, you know. But
no
anyway,
kidding. Like if that relationship went the distance and they got married and they love telling the story of how they met. Like,
Wow, we met
out
in jail
on that forever.
You were in jail, Grandma.
We met in prison.
Anyway, picking up on Laura's comment about things being unexpected, Steele tells her that it just so happens that he has two tickets for the ballet that evening. And what does a city girl have to say to that? And Laura promptly sneezes on his hands and the tickets. He pulls out his handkerchief out of his pocket, hands it to her, and says, "Sit tight."
My theory on Steele at the ballet, okay? She goes, I can totally see Laura loving the ballet.
Are you writing this as a fan fiction?
No, I just think this would be like funny. But I can see her being into it because she has a dance background, athleticism, whatever. And I could see him sleeping on her shoulder, like just snoring lightly, you know, a Swan Lake plays, and like she's nudging him every 3 seconds to like, "You're embarrassing me, like wake up." And then when it's over, I could see him rhapsodizing about how glorious and wonderful he's never slept better, right? Like that's
only that, but at the intermission he'd wake up thinking it was all completely over.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then he'd be like, "Oh my god, there's more."
or as Tim Taylor said in one of the episodes where he and Jill went to go see Waiting for Godot, "You mean I got to see through more of this crap?"
Yeah, I could definitely see that happening. So anyway, I'm just saying that's how that date would go.
Yes. Anyway, so that's the end of the episode. She sneezes on him and he hands her the handkerchief and says, "Gesundheit," and we freeze. And that's it. Anything that you want to add? Anything we missed?
I think like as much as I joked about how terrible the townsfolk are at keeping their secret, I this is an episode. I'm not a huge fan generally of the episodes that take place in like smaller towns. Like there's at least three of them. Steel's Gold, this one, and there's
Corn
one
fed.
Later involving pig farmers or
corn fed
steel.
I can't
remember the name. Yeah, exactly. And they're not generally my favorites, but this episode is quite fun. Like, I think it's a fun little episode with a bunch of like quirky secondary cast members. And when I'm rewatching and making my notes, oftentimes rethinking how I felt about the episode prior to doing this podcast, where I'm like actually having to think about it. And I liked it. I think it was it was cute. Like, did it all make sense? No, doesn't have to. Not always.
It's not an A episode, but it is a good solid B minus.
Yeah. I definitely enjoyed it. So
yeah.
No. For those who think that we're here just to criticize, it's a solid 45 minutes of entertainment. No notes.
It's fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if that's it, we've got a website, www.steelwatching.com. And there you will find show notes, links to Amazon movies for both Amazon US and Canada. So we've got four movies in this one. It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, Bad Day at Black Rock, and In the Heat of the Night. And There you will also at the website find some links to other resources, such as
we have our Facebook fan page, our Instagram, our Twitter, as well as the officially unofficial Steel Watchers Facebook group, where we've had a few people join and say they found us from here. So
yes,
that's super duper cool. And I'm always like, yay, it's always nice to see that, because when we started this, I think you and I assumed that
it would be the other way around.
The bulk of our audience was going to come from the group, which was great. But it's really cool to see others finding us from outside the group and then coming to the group. So
yes,
that's pretty cool.
We are brand ambassadors. That's what we are. Brand ambassadors. If somebody out there listening to this is not a member of the Facebook Steel Watchers group and they join as a result of hearing the podcast, just, you know, drop a line in there that's exactly what happened. It's just nice to know. It's a nice pat on our back. We
stroke in the ego.
Yes. We enjoy, it's not about the ego so much as just knowing that we have been able to contribute back to the group, because the group has been very, very generous and tolerant of us.
Absolutely.
And, it's one of the ways that we know that we are having a positive influence on the group.
Yeah, to help grow the community is possibly the best reward I could see from doing this, to get more people coming in, to get more perspectives on the show and keep it alive after 41 years. I know how old I am because I'm the same age as the show. After almost 42 years, that's pretty.
Yeah. Pretty awesome. I mean, think about it. How many TV shows after having been off the air that long, not only have an active fan community, but an active fan community that is also doing things like creating new fan fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, there are amazing other TV shows that have that, but I mean, like you said, 41 years after the fact, there's not a lot of shows that have that.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome.
So we are in a very small community in that sense, because a lot of the shows, they're 30, 40 years old. Nobody's even heard of them anymore.
Yeah, it's true. So. And someone recognized my sweater today. Like, I'm wearing my Remington Steel sweater, and I was at a vintage collectible toy show, and a woman saw it and she was, "Oh, I love Remington Steel." So I was like, "You should listen to this podcast." I used it as a networking opportunity. Yeah.
I don't know where I heard about this podcast, but you might enjoy it. Yes.
You might enjoy it. Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, maybe we should get some business cards made up so you can hand them out at fan events. You know,
that's not a bad idea, actually, because I do go to a lot of Comic Cons.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a terrible idea.
Anyway, enough about us. Thank you for joining us with this episode. And then next one is yours. It's Molten Steel, a steamy episode that I am surprised made it on the air in 1984.
Oh, this is going to be great. I think the best part of this episode is going to be what they don't talk about.
Or how they don't talk about it.
Exactly.
Or how they kind of don't talk
work
about
around it.
It.
Yes.
Anyway, well, thanks everybody. Thanks for joining us. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey everybody, Eric and Sarah here. Just a quick announcement to let you know that, yes, we do appreciate everyone who listens, participates, and supports the podcast in whatever way you do. But we wanted to give an extra thank you to those who are so graciously giving to be monthly financial supporters.
We are making live streams of our recording sessions available to anyone who is a monthly financial supporter. So not only can you watch us live as we record our podcast episodes, you will be getting access to the raw, behind-the-scenes, unedited version of episodes before they get officially released.
And Sarah, does that include our mistakes and screw-ups and our humiliating?
Oh, yeah. Yes, every single one of them.
Every single one of them, yes. So again, this is just an extra thank you to those who are going above and beyond. But whether you choose to become a monthly financial supporter or not, we still love you. We want to say we thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your feedback.
If you want to become a monthly financial supporter, please visit our website at www.steelwatching.com to sign up.